As you all know from today's invitation, we are fortunate in this Bay Area to have kind of two of the state of Florida's, if not nationally, some of the most significant experts on perhaps both sides of this issue when it comes to gun rights, First Amendment rights, or Second Amendment rights, excuse me, and how that pertains with the evolution in our law. And so the past 2 to 3 years, we have seen an increasing number of bills filed, particularly in Tallahassee, related to this. We will have an early legislative session this year, and we wanted to get a little bit ahead of the curve and bring these folks together to over lunch to speak with you about these issues and better inform all of you, as well as allow you to ask questions that might further deepen our understanding on the issues. We are going to go in alphabetical order, which means the gentleman with the last name Young goes second, so he has more time to eat. So our first guest today is Professor Marjorie Sanfilippo, who is a psychology professor and associate dean of faculty at Eckerd College. She's the author of several empirical articles describing her research on children's behaviors around firearms, particularly following educational interventions. She has testified multiple times in front of the state legislature and has appeared multiple times on national television news programs speaking on her research related to children and firearms. It gives us great pleasure to welcome Margie with us today, and she will give opening remarks of no greater than 10 minutes.
Thank you very much, Kelly. Appreciate that. Thank you all for being here. I'm hoping that this isn't nearly as nerve-wracking as it is to stand up in front of a legislature where you know that all of the people that you're looking at were going to vote against what you are proposing. So this is a little bit of a kinder audience. My talk is not going to be about the Second Amendment. I don't believe that this issue is about the Second Amendment. The right to bear arms is guaranteed by the Constitution. There's no doubt about that. I'm not even particularly opposed to guns. I was raised in a military family by a father who was a military policeman, and we had guns in our home. This is, however, about the limitations to that. In 2008, D.C. versus Heller affirmed that the right to bear arms was an individual right. It wasn't about militias. We don't really know what the founding fathers actually thought, but D.C. versus Heller said that it was an individual right, but that it was not without limits. And they said that there were limits on the people that should own guns. For example, I think we all agree felons probably should not own guns, nor do I think anybody with a history of domestic violence should own a gun. And they also said that there were limits with respect to what they called sensitive areas. Right now, the only sensitive areas nationwide in which guns are not permitted is government buildings, although there is a movement underway in several states to change that. Other sensitive areas, as outlined by D.C. versus Heller, included schools, churches, hospitals, bars, and political venues. My argument and my particular focus is on schools. As Kelly said, I work at Eckerd College. I have been a college professor since 1993, psychology professor, and have watched how students have changed over the last almost 25 years. I'm really dating myself here. And there have been some changes, and I'll describe some of those in just a little bit. I also want to say that this is not about the inadequacies about training for concealed carry permits. All states allow people to conceal carry guns. Most require a permit. Most states require a permit. 11 do not. About half require safety training of some type, but only in 6 states are you required to actually know how to shoot a gun to get a concealed carry permit. It's harder to get your driver's license than it is to get your concealed carry permit. Florida, just by way of mention here, is a shall issue state, not a may issue state, so that's one of the that's less restrictive than a MASU state. You do have to be 21 years old. You pay a $102 fee and go through a background check, although it's not the background check by NICS, the federal government background check. It's by the Department of Agriculture. Then you can have your concealed carry permit. That's residents and non-residents in Florida. So I'm going to turn my attention now to schools, and in particular colleges and universities, and tell you that tell you first that people don't want it. When I say people, I mean college presidents that have signed on, campus safety officers, campus police officers have all come out with statements saying they don't want students to be able to carry concealed on college campuses. Faculty are opposed. Faculty in states where they've passed concealed carry laws have resigned their positions or made other such statements. And even students themselves, three times as many students don't want than do want guns on their college campuses. Students at Eckerd don't even wear shoes. I don't know where they would put guns. So I'm going to read you two quotes and ask you who you think said them. No student shall, within the precincts of the university, introduce, keep, or use weapons or arms of any kind. That would be Thomas Jefferson and James Madison in 1804 speaking about the policy at the University of Virginia, our forefathers. And here's the second one. We believe in absolutely gun-free, zero-tolerance, totally safe schools. That was Wayne LaPierre, president of the National Rifle Association in 1999. Clearly, they have done a complete 180 on that. So why are colleges so sensitive? Why do we want to keep guns off college campuses? I can tell you a couple of reasons. One, the mental health of college students is at its lowest point as it has been in decades. We could have an entire luncheon talking about why that is, but I can tell you that the number of students that have anxiety and depression on college campuses has absolutely skyrocketed. 1,000 students commit suicide every year, and another 20 to 30% think about killing themselves every year. What's interesting is that more students on college campuses use non-lethal means, such as substances, than the same age cohort who live off campuses who are more likely to use weapons. And obviously using a weapon to kill yourself is going to be much more successful, I hate to use that word, in suicide, than to use substances. So that begs the question of why do students off campus use guns and students on campus use substances? And there's many researchers, myself included, who believe that it is about access. A survey that I did of college counselors found that in schools where concealed carry is permitted, they had 42.9% rate of suicides by firearm, and on the campuses where concealed carry was not permitted, that rate was only 13.3%. Another reason why I don't think guns belong on a college campus is because of stress. You add, and really these are all a sort of accumulation of stressors. So we have high rates of mental health, high rates of stress over grades, relationship. 18 to 24 is the age range where most mental illnesses occur, where the greatest amount of stress occurs. They're living in close quarters with one another. They have stress about their future, about how they're going to pay for college, about their grades. And then you add to that the substance abuse on college campuses, which really hasn't changed much since when we were in school, except that it's more dangerous now. Students aren't drinking. We don't have more students drinking. We just have them drinking more dangerously and having to be transported to the hospital with high rates of alcohol poisoning and a combination of alcohol and drugs. Add a gun to that mix, and I think we see why guns aren't allowed in bars. Sensitive topics on college campuses, talking about everything from the riots in Charlottesville, the politics that are going on, all of that. That's pretty typical discourse on a college campus, and tempers can flare, and we don't want guns around that. Lastly, college campuses include stadiums, hospitals, childcare buildings, administrative buildings, offices. Students right now in Texas are allowed to conceal carry into a disciplinary hearing. They aren't even asked to check their guns at the door there. So I have no idea what my partner over here is going to be talking about. I can tell you that when I go to Tallahassee, what I hear a lot of is fear-mongering. The students should have the right to defend themselves against, as Marion Hammer said to me, terrorists, rapists, and murderers on college campuses, which I can tell you, just stroll through Eckerd College campus. Kelly can tell you we don't have a lot of terrorists, rapists, and murderers running around. Campuses are safe. Campuses are safer than the surrounding area, and we want to keep it that way. Finally, I just would like to say that I think that that our policy should be informed by empirical evidence and research, not by fear-mongering, not by anecdotes, and not by overzealous interpretations of the Second Amendment. I think we should abide by what Thomas Jefferson and James Madison said, in that guns have no place on college campuses. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Margie. I won't share what Judge Minkoff said about Eckerd College, but I can have words with him afterwards, as will Mayor Kreisman. Quickly, before I introduce Jeff Young, I failed to mention and thank Radio St. Pete for broadcasting live today's lunch and conversation, and then it will be available on Facebook afterwards via their podcast archive. And then also want to thank 88.5 WMNF Community Conscious Radio for being with us here today as well and continuing to expand the audience for today's conversation. Our second guest today is Jeff Young, affectionately known throughout the state of Florida as the gun lawyer. Jeff is a staunch supporter of the Constitution's Second Amendment, a gun owner and avid shooter, as well as a proud member of the National Rifle Association. He is very active in the Florida gun community, having donated time and effort to numerous gun groups and charities. His personal law practice focuses on representing individuals seeking restoration of their civil right to possess a firearm, drafting a National Firearms Act NFA trust to allow them to purchase suppressors or other NFA items, or also defending people who are forced to use their firearm in self-defense. Jeff has driven all the way up from Sarasota today, and we're very appreciative that you've joined us. Thanks very much, Jeff.
Good afternoon. A couple things real quick. I'm the one who's responsible for the hard break. I do have a 2 o'clock sentencing hearing on a robbery case in Sarasota, so if I'm late, maybe one of the circuit judges can call Judge Riva down there and tell her I'm sorry. I'm not going to talk for 10 minutes. It might be surprising to hear that from a lawyer, but I'll just sum up a few things. They do call me the gun lawyer. It's not a phrase that I picked up. I started doing firearm law a few years ago. I actually have a cousin of mine who owns a firearm shop, and believe it or not, up until about 3 years ago, I had never owned a firearm in my life, and then I started kind of getting into it. I went and bought my first one, got my concealed weapons permit, and kind of really enjoyed everything that was related to the firearm community. They're not all a bunch of Neanderthal, knuckle-dragger, crazy rednecks with shotguns in the back of their car. They're all very straightforward people. They're all good citizens. They're very patriotic Americans, and they're all responsible gun owners. So when I got into that community, I decided that there are a bunch of people who they didn't really have a lot of help with certain issues. I know one of the things that was brought up was felons shouldn't have guns. A lot of people don't know this in Florida, but if you shoplift anything over $300, that makes you a felony. I had a little young girl yesterday who shoplifted one shirt from Saks that was worth $542. She has no prior criminal history, and because she shoplifted one short shirt, she's now a felon. That person is no longer allowed to have a firearm. If you write a worthless check that you know is worthless and you pass it at a bank or a store, that's a felony. So when we talk about these general concepts of, well, this group of people shouldn't be able to have a gun, or this certain people shouldn't be able to have a gun, I think you have to dig a little bit deeper into the nuances. And thankfully, a few years ago, Florida passed a law that allows certain felons to restore their firearm rights. You got to fill out an application and go through the process. But for those people with those type of crimes that I'm talking about, can restore their rights. So I just don't like the idea of painting large swaths of people with inabilities to possess firearms, including college students or people who visit college campuses, there's all kinds of people that go to college campuses. They're just not college students. There's teachers, there's staff, there's parents, there's older students who may be taking night classes or whatever. So, again, you're talking blanket brushes with things when it comes to firearm laws. So what I focus on is I do a lot of self-defense stuff with Stand Your Ground. Everybody's probably heard of Stand Your Ground. There's a lot of self-defense things that happens in Florida, and I help people try and restore their rights that should otherwise be able to have a firearm. I'm not some big super NRA person. I don't push them. I'm a constitutionalist. I believe in states' rights and individual rights, and if a state wants to pass an open carry law, they can. If they don't want to, they don't have to. We can have these debates up in the legislature about firearms on campus, et cetera, and those are great debates to have. But I'm simply here to try and paint a better face to the firearm community, who I believe, and a lot of them believe, kind of get painted with this broad brush of being these bad people who just think everybody should have a gun, whether they're criminals or have mental health problems or whatever, and that's not the vast majority of them. That's not even what the NRA actually believes. So I'm going to stop talking now because I don't have a lot of time. I want to make sure we get to everybody's questions. So thanks for having me, and I look forward, and hopefully I can answer some of your issues.
You're okay. Stay up here.
So we're going to open up the floor now. I've told our frequently overzealous Corey Adler, who's on the gong, that since these are not elected officials, we will be somewhat more lenient in allowing them to get into some of the nuance that Jeff just mentioned in this type of conversation. So we typically limit our responses to 2 minutes, but obviously if either one of you would like a little bit of extra time, I think we're going to have a special exception today. So right now we're going to open it up to Q&A, we will allow both of you to go back and forth, and I'm going to give you, Jeff, a mic as well. So, Margie, if you want to pick your first question.
Yeah, Margie. Corey? All overzealously tiny. Hi, I'm Corey Adler, the overzealous person. Mr. Young.
Yes, ma'am.
I'm trying to understand how I can relate to members of the NRA who are law-abiding citizens, not taking up the cause to not allow guns to be sold, for instance, at gun shows, and why military-type weapons are allowed to be sold. I don't understand why they're not in front of that issue so that their reputation is not tainted by the people who are using them inappropriately. So why aren't they in front of this issue?
We'll take two issues. The first one is the gun show. There is no such thing as a gun show loophole. If you go to a gun show, you're going to find two types of people selling guns there. You're going to find gun shops who take their stuff on the weekend and go set up a gun show. They have to go through a background check. You buy a gun from those people at the gun show, it's just like if you bought it at the shop. You have to fill out the same background form. They call FDLE. They run through all the paperwork. You do everything you do at the shop. So there is background checks at gun shows. Second table at a gun show is usually a really old guy who's got a few old handguns and maybe a few old rifles that are sitting up there that he calls his personal collection. If you buy from that guy, you don't have to go through a background check because that's considered a private sale. That would happen whether it was at the gun show or you bought it at his garage sale or he was on a Facebook sale post or whatever. So the gun show issue, it's fake. There's no such thing as a gun show loophole. If you go into a gun show and buy from a dealer, you have to go through a background check. If you buy from a private person, it's not just because they're at the gun show, it's because they're a private person. So what you're really talking about is banning private sales, essentially saying you can't do a private sale or a private transfer of a firearm without doing a background check. So that would encompass a father who wanted to hand a firearm down to his child as a gift. It would cover a husband who bought a gun and wanted to give it to his wife for her birthday. He would have to do a background check before he could give her the firearm. So the issue isn't gun shows, the issue is private sales. And if people want to ban private sales, then that's a discussion that we can have. But to phrase it as a gun show loophole is incorrect. The second issue that I'll discuss about is these military-style weapons. The problem with that is definition. We're lawyers, so everything that we talk about involves definition. What is a military-style weapon? Are you talking about how it looks? Because you can take a rifle that shoots a .22 caliber bullet, which is the smallest bullet that they make, and dress it all up black and scary and call it an assault rifle. Or you can take that same bullet, or you take a larger bullet, which is a 5.56, which is a military round, and you can put it in a bolt-action rifle, which only fires one shot at a time. So are we talking about how the firearm looks,
Are we talking about the size of the caliber? Assault, as the lawyers will tell you, is an action. It's not an item. It's not a product. There's no such thing as an assault weapon. It's a made-up term that doesn't cover any firearm that I've ever seen or I'm made aware of. So I think the NRA and most firearms problems have to do with the fact that you can't define that term and it just opens it up to too big of an issue. Are they made specifically just to kill? I mean, I guess you can make that argument, but then we wouldn't have military to protect ourselves, and we wouldn't have policemen. I mean, are policemen not allowed to have firearms? Because the same industry that sells me the gun that I carry every day, a Glock, is the same industry that sells those Glocks to law enforcement and to military people. So if you're talking about an industry, they have to make firearms for other things than just, again, the rednecks or the people who support those things. But yes, I mean, I'll tell you what you're going to hear, and you're not going to want to hear it, but people enjoy firearms for all various kinds of reasons. They can use them to hunt. They can use them to shoot. There's all kinds of sports for it. It's still in the Olympics. People use it for home defense. I'm not going to defend an industry. I'm going to defend a way of life that people enjoy here in America, and the industry provides a tool that people enjoy that. If you're not going to ever think that people should have firearms and they shouldn't be manufactured, there's nothing I can say to change somebody's mind on that issue.
I'd like to add something to that as well. The problem with it as an industry is that it is one of the few industries that's allowed to produce a product that's not overseen by the Consumer Product Safety Commission. The reason that children don't die in cars as much as they used to is because the Consumer Product Safety Commission said we need to have ways for people to get out of trunks when they lock themselves in, and we need to put seatbelts in cars, and we need to find a way to make them safer. We need to think about firearms, at least with respect to children, as a public health nuisance. We put gates around our swimming pools. We put caps on our childproof caps on pill bottles. We need to keep guns safe and out of the hands of children, and that's an adult's responsibility, not a child's.
I agree, it's an adult responsibility, and we have product liability lawsuits. People make firearms. If they had firearms that just accidentally went off and killed people, that company would be out of business. They'd be sued for millions of dollars. They'd be gone. Nobody would ever buy their product. Again, I don't know how familiar people are with guns, but they all come with safeties. You can buy some guns that don't have your traditional safeties, but every gun comes with a style of safety. Every gun is now sold because of federal law with a trigger lock on it. Every time you buy a gun in a box, it comes with this big old lock that you can put around your trigger. So they are regulated. They are subject to the same safety kind of concepts that most other products are, and they're obviously regulated by the general public as it relates to what they can buy and who they can sue. So to say that they're unsafe products, it just doesn't make any sense, because they wouldn't be made if they went off every time you dropped them on the ground.
Yes, sir.
As a graduate of the University of Virginia, I certainly follow the events in Charlottesville quite closely this weekend. The governor of Virginia said that roughly 80% of the the original protesters, you call them what you want, were armed. And that on Saturday, the police felt somewhat intimidated and outgunned in that situation. And I know if I'd have been a counter-protester, I would have been very uncomfortable. So my question to either of you is, would you concede we could have a situation where the Second Amendment right to bear arms overwhelms the First Amendment's right to free speech and protest?
Ladies first.
So you're asking what? So let me see if I understand correctly what you're asking. You're asking whether or not the Second Amendment right supersedes the First Amendment right to free speech?
Not necessarily, but I can envision a situation where protesters from now on say white supremacy issues, totally showed up armed to the teeth. And if I present that and I want to protest against that, I'm intimidated by the show of arms on the other side. And the police certainly have to be very frightened that someone's going to start shooting.
Well, and I certainly agree that the police must be extremely frightened with everything that's going on nowadays. I mean, I think that that's something else that's been overshadowed recently, right? Not knowing who's carrying a gun, or in this case you knew, you could see because they were open carrying. Virginia's an open carry state. Made what could have been a peaceful demonstration a volatile situation. As soon as a gun comes out, then clearly everybody is going to become that much more frightened. The tension's going to be heightened, and it's no surprise that people were injured and that the young woman was killed, although she was killed with a car, not with a gun. So I don't really know the answer to your question. Perhaps Jeff has a better idea. It's just a dreadful situation.
Well, the only thing I would say is the argument may hold some water, except for the fact that didn't happen in this case. If 80% of them were armed, it obviously didn't stop the counter-protesters from showing up, and the fight still occurred. And even though 80% of them were armed, I mean, the video was almost hilarious. They've got shields with symbols on them and wooden swords that look like a Harry Potter play. So if 80% of them were armed, it obviously didn't stop the counter-protesters from coming. The fight still occurred, and as she mentioned, the only person who actually did end up dying was killed by a car, and nobody was shot. So I guess I could see a situation where people might be afraid, but it doesn't look like we're in a situation in America where anybody's afraid to do anything. So I don't think, no matter how many guns you bring, it's going to stop people on the other side from showing up and voicing their opinion or picking a fight or, you know, whatever you think happened in Charlottesville that day. As far as law enforcement goes, that's the same fear that they have every day. I mean, every time they do a traffic stop on a vehicle, it's possible that the person's armed. Every time they go to a domestic violence call at a house, somebody could be armed. They're trained, they're, you know, armed themselves. I'm going to trust that they are able to deal with those situations in a reasonable way, as I have yet to see any sort of mass protest break out into, you know, a major gunfight on the street.
Representative Newton, I disrespect you. My question goes, I guess, in framing more so to hate and what transpired over the weekend. I just want to know, when you speak about people's Second Amendment rights, do you think that the gentleman that went into the Boston nightclub with a high-profile assault rifle that murdered 49 people, his rights was even more protected than the people that got killed in that club? And that's pertaining to the Second Amendment, right? And the right to bear, lawfully bear arms.
No, I mean, his rights aren't any more bigger than anybody else's rights. I mean, I'll give you the standard line. Everybody about that. If the people inside the club had been able to exercise their Second Amendment rights, they would have perhaps prevented him from killing anybody. And what about his Second Amendment right? He passed the background check. I mean, all these rules that people are talking about, he went through on that. If I recall, the guy was a licensed security guard, which is an even bigger process and a bigger background check than buying a firearm does. So if your concern is, I don't know how you would have prevented Second Amendment rights or whatever wouldn't have prevented that guy from getting any firearms. They already passed all the laws that are in existence. He bought them legally. If your concern is the type of weapon that he used, if I recall, he also had a couple of handguns on him as well. So when you're talking about, again, a military assault rifle, the standard magazine capacity for, let's say, an AR-15 is 15 rounds or 30 rounds. You can get handguns that have magazines with the same amount of rounds that fire 45 caliber or 9mm caliber, which are just as damaging as any round that you can put into a rifle. So again, are we talking about trying to prevent crimes, or are we talking about trying to remove guns from the streets? Are we talking about magazine capacity? Are we talking about type of firearm? I think the issue comes in, it's not a matter of whether his rights trump anybody else's, it's whether, what do you think you could do in that situation that would prevent that? Because every law that's already on the books prevented it. So other than a ban that says he can't buy any firearm, there was no way to stop something like that. So the only thing I would argue is that it's a tragic situation, it was horrific, and he deserves to be punished, and whoever does any of those things deserve to be punished. But taking away what you want to propose is to say that nobody can have a firearm or an assault rifle. So what you're saying is that now I, who had nothing to do with the Pulse shooting, is now not going to be permitted to buy a firearm that I want to buy because of what this idiot did. And that's not how we should live as a society. The good people should not have to change their behavior to comport with what the bad people do. The bad people need to change their behavior to comport with what the good people do. So to handle a situation like that, you need to deal with the people, not the product.
Can I add, am I allowed to add?
Yeah.
Okay. I do want to say one thing, and that is that it's a myth that it takes a good guy with a gun to stop a bad guy with a gun. We know that defensive use of firearms is pretty much unheard of. Most people who commit crimes, there have been other people, and I won't say most, there have been situations where there's been a good guy with a gun. In other words, a good guy with a gun is a guy with a gun who hasn't used it badly yet. Who didn't even use it to defend. So this idea that we're going to somehow arm all of the good citizens so they can take out all the bad citizens is just going to create mayhem, and the police are going to come into the situation and not know, you know, the good guy isn't wearing a shirt that says, I'm the good guy, don't shoot me, and you're just going to have, you're going to have all sorts of collateral damage, and it's just me and I'm here.
I'll just respond real quick. Obviously, I disagree with that. There's all kinds of statistics out there. You can look them up yourself on Google that talk about how many times people use firearms every year to defend themselves. As a criminal defense attorney, I get people that hire me all the time in self-defense and stand your ground cases who were completely justified in using their firearm. There's YouTube videos. I mean, it happens all the time. And if I'm faced with the option of not being able to protect myself and my family versus being able to protect myself and my family, I would at least rather have that option than have it taken away and be cowering in the bathroom waiting for the guy to come after me next with his gun because I can't do anything about it. Here in the next row.
I think so. In the back there.
Thank you. Joanna Lentino, school board member for Pinellas County Schools. We can debate the Second Amendment probably until the cows come home. However, there's a proliferation of handguns that are stolen every year, and children are needlessly killed. Crimes are needlessly committed by people who have stolen these guns. How, without going back to the Second Amendment, how do you foresee a person such as you, Mr. Young, who's a responsible citizen, who has probably locked his gun up very well and make sure nobody gets offended by somebody breaking into your house, but how do we protect against ourselves of people who have guns, who have seen children murdered, who have seen crimes committed with guns that are stolen over and over again?
Well, there's already laws on the books for people like that. We have laws in Florida that if you leave your firearm out unattended and the children can get around it, that it happens all the time. I mean, you can be as responsible. I mean, I guess I don't... It's not this concept that I don't know of any responsible gun owner that I know of that just like leaves their gun in a Walmart bathroom and then somebody can pick it up. It's usually because a criminal has broken into a house and stolen firearms from somebody's sanctuary or broken into their car and stole it from their locked glove compartment. So rather than focus on the victim of the crime, who's a person who had their personal space violated, I say we have stronger penalties for the person who's going around and breaking into people's houses and stealing firearms, which we do here in Florida. If you break into somebody's house without a gun, that's considered a burglary. If you steal somebody's gun while you're in there, it now becomes an armed burglary, which Florida kicks into mandatory penalties for that with lengthy prison systems, et cetera, et cetera. So I think the way to handle that is, again, not infringing on my rights to be able to possess a firearm because you're afraid that I may leave it out somewhere unattended, but how about we have stronger crimes and stronger prosecutions and stronger law enforcement directed at the people who are stealing the guns in the first place before they get out on the street? Because otherwise, I don't know what else to do. Then you're back to saying nobody can have any firearms because a criminal may steal them. So, again, now we're saying that the good people have to conform their behavior to the bad people, and I prefer that the bad people conform their behavior to the good people.
I absolutely agree that there's a problem with people leaving their firearms loaded and within reach of children. It's their parents, it's their uncles, it's their mothers, it's the woman who let her gun roll into the back of the truck and her two-year-old picked it up and shot her through the back, right? And yes, Florida has a child access protection law. And if you leave your gun out and a child uses it and kills himself or his best friend or his brother, it's a misdemeanor. You might as well go steal a shirt.
Yeah, I don't have a problem making that a stronger crime. It should be a lot higher than that, and certainly if somebody's injured. Jim?
Jim Gillespie. What is it in our culture or our social conditions that make us so avid about weapons and self-protection? When I was in the military, trained in weapons and stationed in Great Britain, the police had to get special permission to get weapons. People do not carry weapons, mostly in Western Europe and Japan. They have lower crime and murder rates. What is the distinction? Why do we not come closer to that level of civilization than we do weaponized?
I think that a large part of it is we're a relatively new country. You know, this country was founded on taking up arms against, you know, Great Britain. And then we have this whole myth of the cowboys and the Indians and all that. And I think that that's a big part of what sort of informs our current culture. I think it's a shame. I wish we were like some of these other third world countries, given that we have this ridiculously high rate of firearm-related violence. It's embarrassing, quite honestly. But I do think that that's part of the reason why it's just our myth.
Yeah, I would agree. It's just a cultural thing. I mean, that's kind of how our country was started. It's why the founders put the Second Amendment in the Constitution to begin with. We have a rich history of firearms dominating the country. I mean, we have a lot of distinctions. We have a lot more cars than people have in other countries because a car was a big thing in the 40s and 50s in America and branching out or whatever. It's just a historical context of the country, and this is where we're at.
Dean Campbell, I'm a circuit court judge in the St. Pete's Courthouse. And so there's currently a bill filed that would allow a gun permit holder to bring firearms into the courthouse. So my question is, what public policy would that be for, and what kind of problem are we trying to remedy?
Well, I want to clarify courthouse, obviously. The way it works now is when you go into court, they wand you at the front desk, obviously, and then you go to your courtroom. If you're a law enforcement person, you go through the wand, and you take your gun, and they usually have a little security thing in the back, and you check your gun, and then you can go to your courtroom. So we're talking about courthouse versus courtroom. And the reason I would personally be in favor for that is because I do criminal defense work. I also do a lot of family law. And as you can imagine, there are a bunch of more crazy people doing family law than you usually find in criminal. I get somebody to take 10 years in prison better than give up an overnight with their child. So there are a lot of people out there that I don't think probably like me, either former clients or people on the other side, etc. And I can tell you personally, the place that I feel the most vulnerable is when I have to park in the parking lot from the courthouse and walk a couple of blocks to go into the courtroom to have my divorce hearing. Now that person knows that I'm coming to court that day because they're also there for the same divorce hearing. So why I'm in favor of it is, if I'm a carrying concealed permit holder, I don't know why I can't be treated like a law enforcement officer, where I can carry my firearm with me while I'm walking from the parking lot and I'm the most vulnerable. And when I go through security, I can check my firearm into the secure box in the back just like law enforcement do. I'm not asking, and I don't think the law says that we can bring it to your courtroom, for example, in the middle of a heated divorce hearing or whatever. But there's no reason why I shouldn't be allowed to at least bring my firearm to the security and check it into the back just like law enforcement does to protect me in the spot when I'm the most vulnerable. I mean, if somebody tries to do something in my office, I pity them because they're not going to get very far past the front door or at my house. But in that area of time, it's very scary when you're a lawyer dealing with these volatile cases, and I don't see why I can't just carry to the security and leave it in the box. So that's what I would say is the public policy. Okay, well, that's what I would favor as a bill. If it says something different, if it says I can carry it into a courthouse or a courtroom, into your courtroom, I would be against that. There's no reason why anybody should have them in the courtroom or the bathroom or the elevator, because at that point, the security, and it's not a big deal, there's bailiffs everywhere, they have their own firearms. But coming in and checking it at the front desk behind security, I don't see how that would affect anybody's safety other than mine for not being able to carry a gun. Do you want to?
Sure. Over here.
Willie Radowski. We regulate cars and pharmaceuticals. Why can't we regulate weapons?
Is it your position that firearms are not regulated? Because we just talked about how I can't bring a firearm into a courthouse. I can't bring a firearm into an airport. Now I can't bring a firearm into a bar, a school, a sporting event. I have to go through a background check whenever I want to buy it. Businesses are permitted to tell me I can't bring into their office. When I buy the firearm, it comes with a lock. I have to go through a training video or a training seminar to get a concealed weapons permit. There are literally, the last time I checked, about 40,000 different laws, both federal and state, regulating firearms. So this notion that people always talk about, why can't we regulate firearms, it is probably the most regulated industry that we have in America.
Excuse me, you asked me a question.
Okay. Sorry, go ahead.
Please let me answer it.
Please do.
We regulate them for safety. We regulate who can have them. We would get licensing for them that's shown on them so people know things. We have insurance for them. There seems to be much more regulation on many other things than there are on firearms. That was the way I was trying to do it, not that you were restricted.
I would like to add what I would at least like to see is that if somebody is going to get a concealed carry permit or have a firearm at all, that they have to go through more extensive training than they currently do. I think that everyone, every state should have to do that. You should have to, and you should have repeated training. You should have to go back for additional training, and you should have to register your firearm. If it's stolen, that way we can track it. We can track it down, right? Or we'll know if it's yours when we find it. The fact that you can actually get a concealed carry permit and not know how to fire a gun is like getting a driver's license and not knowing how to drive a car. It's ridiculous.
Well, I don't. When I took my concealed weapons class, they take you to a range and you shoot multiple different calibers with multiple different guns, and you're actually required to fire the firearm and work it correctly before they'll give you a graduation certificate so you can get your concealed weapons permit. So I don't know what you're talking about. But
you don't have to do that in the state of Florida. You don't have. You do have to do a hunter safety training course or an NRA training course, but you don't have to be able to show that you are proficient in handling
you,
a gun.
You have to fire a gun in order to get your certificate. That is the way the classes work. But I'll just disagree with you when you say we regulate who can drive cars, but we regulate who can have firearms. We've talked about that. Felons can't have them. People with domestic violence injunctions can't have them. People who have been Baker Act or mental health committed can't have them. People who get a medical marijuana license that's now legal in the state of Florida still can't purchase a firearm from a gun dealer because the federal government doesn't allow you to do so. So we absolutely regulate who can have them. We regulate who can get a license to use them. You have to take a class. You have to go through the background check through the Department of Agriculture. So, again, this idea that they're unregulated, they're just unregulated firearms wandering around out there that we don't have any laws against that is just nonsense.
Hi, my name is Deidre Roberts, and I'd like to know who is the good guy and who's the bad guy in the Cobb Theater murder?
Well, he's obviously the bad guy, which is why he was charged. He's now facing a murder charge, and that was not a stand your ground case. I don't believe that it ever was, which is why the judge threw it out, and he's probably going to spend the rest of his life in jail, as he should. And he, by the way, obviously was a long-term police officer who had a lot of training. The very people that people think are the only ones who should ever have firearms in our society, not civilians, but government people like law enforcement officers, and yet this was one of those, and we saw what he did, too. So.
Well, exactly. Like I said earlier, the good guy with a gun is only good until he uses it in a bad way. And we just never know when that's going to happen. I think it's your turn.
You gotta make it walk all the way over there.
I know, we're getting close on time.
Bruce Marger, you made arguments against the assault weapon by saying that you can make a multi-fired weapon in any with a large capacity. I recognize that. You also spoke against the armored type of piercing bullet by saying you can have that fired from another type of weapon. My question is, why have any of these since they overpower the police? And the reason that they didn't go into Pulse was because they were afraid of all of these things being possessed by the madman.
Is your question why we continue to allow that type of weaponry and those types of ammunition?
In any weapon. Don't give it the name assault weapon. In any weapon, why do they need it? Why can they outfire the police?
I don't disagree with you. So, like I said, this was a little bit easier than the other talks I've had to give. You know what? Somebody said something to me one time, and he was joking, but I think it was a great solution to some of our problems. We don't need to make guns harder to get. We need to make bullets harder to get. Let's make bullets really, really expensive. If that bullet you bought costs $100, you're going to be really careful before you shoot it.
I'd like Jeff to address that. If you use that argument.
Well, I'm never for the government getting involved in making prices higher on a product to serve a political or a social goal. But what I'll say about the ammunition, again, I think your problem is when you get into definitions, people throw out the word armor piercing. Well, what does that mean? There's all kinds of different bullets out there these days. Are we talking about caliber? Are we talking about penetration effect? If you say outshoot the cops, have you seen the firearms that the cops have lately? I've seen them driving down the road with tanks. They all have these assault weapons in their car. They all have sidearms. They carry at least 17 rounds. Most of them carry Glock 17 or a SIG. They carry 17 rounds, and they're usually also hollow point armor piercing style rounds at all. So this misnomer that what civilians have is more than what any government agency has is just not correct.
Kelly.
Thank you both. This is an excellent conversation. I'd like to hear both of your suggested solutions to the proliferation of copycat on-campus shootings since Columbine. Malcolm Gladwell has done some research on this, and what legislation would look like for both of you that might address how do we stop that proliferating, and if there is a shooting, that we don't have 30, 40 children dead, but we minimize that impact that might go beyond arming every teacher on campus.
Are you talking about college campuses or K-12 or both?
Elementary through college.
Okay. Well, I do think that one of the solutions might be better mental health care. We on college campuses, I have seen a significant increase in the number of students with pretty serious psychological disorders, and at the same time, the funding for counselors and outreach individuals has remained steady, if not gone down. So that, I think, is one solution, is better mental health care, better screening of students before they come on campus. But we're still talking about a relatively rare event, right? So mass shootings, even, I wouldn't have used the word, Kelly, proliferation, because I don't think it's been that bad. They're still relatively, thank goodness, rare events.
And I think to that point, part of the issue is when you talk about copycats, I think the reason that you may have those type of things is because they are very rare. They account for an infinitesimal number of firearm deaths. Even anything from these assault rifles counts for less than 2% of firearm deaths every year, and they account for less than 1% of firearm injuries. It's mostly the handguns that do that. But I think what happens is when these incidents occur, the media jumps in, and it becomes one of these biggest news stories, as it should be. I'm not saying they shouldn't cover, 30 children being murdered at a school, but I think the copycats come more from that style of issue than it actually does from the firearms. When we started with Columbine, if we all recall, Columbine happened in the middle of the last assault weapon ban that we had. It was a 10-year ban where we weren't allowed to purchase and manufacture new firearms. And the Columbine shooting happened right in the middle of that ban. So I would argue, obviously, that means that the ban was ineffective. There's been all kinds of studies that talk about how after the 10 years of the ban, you didn't see any significant decrease in any sort of firearm crimes or these mass shooting crimes. The mass shooting crimes are awful, and they get all the attention. But 90-something% of the deaths that happen in America, especially ones with children, are handgun related. So if the problem that we're trying to get to is solving firearm deaths, then we don't start with assault weapons bans, because that's not going to solve the problem, because it's less than 2% of the shootings. What you really have to do is deal with the handguns. And the only way to deal with the handguns, and nobody likes to hear this, is you have to ban them. You basically have to make them illegal. But nobody talks about banning handguns, because there's all kinds of political stuff that comes along with that. The only thing that I'll sum up, because I've really got to go or I'm going to get in trouble, but we can end on agreement. I think mental health is really the biggest problem. And I know people always hear the NRA say that we should focus on mental health, but even people who don't like the NRA will agree. We have a bad mental health problem in the country in general, and especially in the state of Florida. They shut down a lot of the state hospitals back in the day. There's no place for these people to go. We have all kinds of mental health people that come through the criminal justice system. I'm sure the judges can attest to that. We started something in Sarasota called Mental Health Court, which is kind of like a diversion program where we can put these people. But the one common factor, I mean, obviously, not stupid, a common factor is that there was a firearm involved. But the second common factor in all of these mass shootings specifically is always a mental health situation. I mean, you're not going to find one of those people that didn't have some sort of a mental health problem or drug addiction or whatever. So I would, again, rather focus on the person than the product, because I think when we do that, either through mental health counseling or stronger laws or longer prison sentences, you're going to solve this problem that we have with firearms in our country more than actually doing anything with the product. Because again, the product affects the good people, it doesn't affect the bad people. Sorry, I've got to go. I apologize, everybody. Thank you very much for your time. Thank you for listening. Thank you very much. It's nice to meet you. Thank you very much.
Maybe give a thank you very much, Jeff and Margie. And you're gonna miss the photo with the award winner for the toughest question, but that's all right. We'll Photoshop you in. While those are brought up, I wanted to give you a heads up on upcoming programs. September 7th, we're going to have candidates for St. Pete City Council District 2, Brandy Gabbard and Barclay Harless, hosted here again at the St. Pete Yacht Club. And then on September 27th, we're going to have a conversation on medical marijuana and perhaps gubernatorial races with John Morgan here at the St. Pete Yacht Club as well.